Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BrickFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is a neighbour from Leighton, which is a rare treat for me, as I don't often get to speak to people face-to-face. But my guest is more famous, I suppose, for being that in-house remixer and DJ for Indie Rockers Hi-Fi. I'm talking to DJ Wrong Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Cheers for getting us in.
You may or may not be surprised. You're not the longest I've taken to arrange to interview somebody. I've managed to take, I think, 3 years once.
This was about 3 years.
Are we 3 years? Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, maybe you equaled it.
Because we spoke, must have been about, it was 2020. It was probably during lockdown.
Yeah.
And I'd just moved pretty much across the road from you at the time. And I think I had this thing at the back of my mind that, like, maybe I should do something a little bit more film related to justify being on the show, on your podcast. No one knows anything about any of my film credentials, if you could call them that.
Well, the great thing is I've developed a format which allows people without direct film credentials now to come on to talk about their fandom of film, which is three films that have impacted every day of their life. And you've given me three films. But I'd like, while I've got you here, I'd like to take advantage of that and ask you a couple of questions about the art of remixing and producing, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let me start at the top so you can give people an example of your work. What's a favourite remix you've done of an existing song or tune, and why is it a favourite?
That is a tough one because I've done a lot of remixes. I was trying to work it out a little while ago. I think it's nearing almost 300.
Okay, should I revise the question to what's an interesting remix you've had to do and why is it interesting?
No, I mean, like, if there is a favourite.
Okay.
Because I've thought about this a lot, and I often think about favourites anyway. You know, I would think about, like, favourite films, favourite songs, whatever, and it's almost ridiculous to have one particular song. But there is, and for me, it was when, around the time I started doing the Hi-Fi stuff, they got me to remix a track called Middle Eastern Holiday, which was almost a single. And then at the last minute, I think someone at the label or someone in the band realized that it was a bit of an odd song. It's in three sections. It's kind of like this up-tempo rock tune. And then suddenly it turns into this kind of dubby track in the middle. It's very, very Clash-esque. And it was kind of like, okay, this isn't going to be the single, but we're giving you the stems anyway. So, you know, carry on with your remix. And it ended up as the B-side for the single, I think it was the second single, Tied Up Too Tight, maybe. And I did one mix. I decided, because it had these three sections, that I was going to do three different remixes. So I did one that was this kind of downbeat, almost like a funk thing, which didn't quite work, but it got released. And then I took the middle section, which was the dub section. And I just thought, right, I'm going to do something that really sounds like an old kind of Augustus Pablo dub record of some sort. And then I had another one, which was a kind of almost like post-punk disco kind of thing, like real kind of sort of thing that LCD Sound System are doing in the noughties. And then I found out Chicken Lips had done one for the same tune exactly like that and delivered it. So I was like, okay, ditch that one and focus on the dub. And I'd been thinking about doing dub stuff since I was a teenager and I started playing in bands. And I was always kind of like, is it really my place to do it? Then I thought, well, fuck it. I've been listening to this stuff, you know, since I was a kid. And if I can do it, then it's my place to do it, right? So I gave it a go and it wound up coming out as a 7-inch that came free with the album if you bought it from HMV, which was a weird thing because, you know, people were buying a CD of it and getting this 7-inch of a dub tune. Two sides. It's got me playing melodica on one side, like, you know, Augustus Pablo style. And I'm sure most people that got it, some of them probably didn't even have anything to play it on. And then other people would put it on and go, what? But anyway, yeah, I just love the fact that they decided that it was worth doing this and yeah. It became this like weird little collectible oddity. But the thing that got me about it was I had a vision for it and it worked. And it was the first time after, I'm self-taught, you know, I took up producing pretty much, well, I left uni in 99 and I bought some gear and thought, right, I'm going to teach myself to do this because I've been playing in bands for years and it's always a compromise and it's always a pain in the ass. And I want to learn to do this myself and be able to just do what's in my head and get it out there. And then I sat down and realized that I'm not quite capable of that. So yeah, so it must have been, what, like 2004, I think I was making it. So 5 years down the line of like teaching myself relentlessly, trying to get this off the ground. You know, I'd been a dolly.
When you're self-taught, what is it? What was the hardest, the biggest hill to climb in terms of self-taught musician?
I mean, it's hard to say because I don't know what the alternative is.
Well, okay. But, what do you remember being the hardest thing to do though, in terms of like what you were, when you were trying to achieve something that it never was sounding how you know, when you say, I want this to sound like this, it's not sounding like this.
I mean, that is the hardest thing. Isn't it? It's like trying to find the way of getting it done and then, you know, YouTube didn't exist. You couldn't watch people to learn how they played something. And what I wound up doing was just getting lots of instruments and learning to play them, like, you know, learning the basic rudiments of things. Yeah. So originally my idea was like, if I'm going to be a producer, I'm going to teach, you know, like, not teach, I'm going to be able to show people what I want or like what I want them to do. And it's good to have a basic knowledge of what they're doing. And after a bit, I was like, well, if I just learn to play them well enough to record a bit of it and chop it up, then I could save money on having session musicians and stuff like that. But yeah, it's like an intangible thing for me. It happened and I managed to overcome that hurdle with that track.
Because I think that's one of the things, you know, you think of a band like The Fall, and Marky Smith's turnover of band members because he couldn't play a note.
Yeah.
So he had to get collaborators in to then explain this intangible until they got it right, which you can see why he probably had a high turnover of band members.
But that's, I mean, it's almost like a situationist experiment, The Fall, isn't it? And there's one Fall song that I absolutely love. It's not his song, it's a cover of The Monks. Is it The Monks? No, hang on. No, the song's called Black Monk 2.
Is it the Monks?
Yeah,
it's the Black Monks. So
it's produced by Cold Cut, weirdly. It's almost like a house tune.
Hmm.
And I think it was a B-side. And there's a bit where there's a key change and he literally just goes, key change, because he's obviously like the first time he's heard this. And it's him just kind of responding to what other people are doing. So like there probably was a point where he's trying to get people to do what he wanted, but there's also that other side of The Fall where people did stuff and he just responded to it and gave you a running commentary of what was happening.
There's a Mouse on Mars one that's quite similar to that, but where they're collaborating with him and the beginning of the track is him telling him what he wants. He goes, I want the drum to go doo, 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 and then the tune just becomes the tune. You stop hearing him, but they put his voice in the beginning of the recording, like the key change.
Yeah, brilliant.
For the layperson, now, we know what a musician is. They go in the studio, they make music, or they go on stage, they make music. But can you explain the role of a producer in relation to when you're making an album? What is it? How would you describe it? Because producers get a lot of credit or producers are completely anonymous, it seems to me.
Somewhere between the two, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a real grey area now anyway. I mean, there was, you know, traditionally back in the day, the producer was that guy in the suit that was in the room that was basically like, telling the musicians what to play and how to play it, when to stop. And gradually, somewhere down the line, they became an artist in their own right.
Yeah, that's what.
So it's a really hard thing to answer now. And it's going to, from my point of view, I'm an artist producer, okay. I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't like any of these terms. Mm. You know, I'm just a guy that bashes away and makes sounds. But yeah, I mean, essentially that's what I am. I'm like, you know, I'm my name as an artist and I produce tunes and I get people in to play stuff, but I also play stuff myself.
Mm.
But yeah, in the modern sense, I think a producer is, I mean, they're kind of everything now. It's almost like you with like having to keep an eye on your levels, on your sound recorder and your interviewing me. It's like we've all got to be all of these things now.
Yeah.
But traditionally a producer is the person that has like a kind of an idea of a sound and an aesthetic and has like the bigger picture of what an album is going to be or what a song is going to be and gets everyone in place. I guess like in some ways it's not the same as a film because a producer is probably more creative than a producer on film.
Yeah.
You know,
but then again, you know, if you think about, I mean, I'm the sort of biggest example I can think of where the producer made a difference in terms of a band. And I don't mean that good or bad. If you listen to Nevermind and In Utero.
Yeah.
They sound like different bands because of the producer that made the record, not because none of the band members changed.
Yeah.
But the producer did, and that ended up being the sound, didn't it?
Totally. And it was like it was how he got them to play. And sometimes you get a band that they just can't stand what a producer did to them. That's and right. It would be like a massive album. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there's albums out there where they were a fantastic success and the band are like, we hate that because it didn't sound like us.
I can't think of it, if I think it was the producer's fault, but I know that was certainly the Lars story. They were never happy with the sound they created. Or even Kevin Shields on Loveless. Mm. He was never happy with what the sound of Loveless.
No.
They drove Creation to bankruptcy. But you've been working in music now, what, for more than two decades now as a kind of, as a job?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, like quote unquote, professionally 20 years.
So 20 years where obviously you were a fan first and you're still a fan to this day. How does someone working with music, trying to create music, trying to keep their head in the music game, as it were, how do you keep the flame of being a music fan alive?
I don't.
Okay.
No.
It just hasn't stopped. Now?
I think, no. It's funny. I think because I've never been that successful, you know, like to the degree of like, you know, it barely pays my mortgage, you know, like I just about keep afloat from it. It's not like I've ever had a massive hit.
Right.
And in some ways that's great because it means that I don't have something that I have to replicate or something that like, well, you did that. We want you to keep doing this.
Okay.
So I've always managed to just keep plowing along and learning new stuff as I go and doing fresh stuff and doing the things that I want to do. Because there's no kind of like there's no need to hark back to something and say I need to put bums on seats. I need to get this many people listening to it. No one's going to go, oh well, you know, you haven't replicated what you did with that record because like you know so many people still come to me and go like, well, what have you done? You've been around for 20 years. What have you been doing? And you know, with Hardfy, it's funny because people are kind of like, oh, you work with Hardfy, and like there's a certain demographic that like, oh, you know, indie pop, really? And then they find out what I did was make difficult dub records that like somehow Atlantic Records bankrolled. And I've just had a really strange niche in the industry. And I've been very lucky in that respect. And also unlucky because I've never made any money.
Because in that 20 years, essentially we've gone from a sort of predominantly physical media to every single piece of music is almost at our fingertips now. And as a fan, as a person trying to make music and be inspired by music, how in this modern era do you allow yourself to either A, plow your own furrow, which is kind of what would have happened when, because in many ways to me, it feels like music and film, very similar. They've got cheaper, so it's easy to get more access to it. Whereas when I first started out with any of it, everything you bought was precious because it was expensive as an item.
Yeah.
But also, how do you find hidden gems if you're going to be like remixing or you're going to be introducing some new sound that's going to be a surprise to people but exciting when everyone else can Google, everyone else can search? So,
well, Well, I think it's, I mean, one of the things is people still go for the stuff that they know.
Okay.
Even with all that stuff out there. So all it really means is there's more of a chance that you're going to find hidden gems because somebody that's got a real love for it has gone out and compiled an album of like weird, you know, some kind of like psych Welsh folk or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
there's ways of discovering stuff that you wouldn't have been able to do before without going to a place, like flying to another country and being that person digging through vinyl. So there's obviously, there's more opportunity to be a specialist in some ways.
Okay, that's interesting.
But at the same time, there's also stuff that isn't up there, which makes it even more precious. And it was funny. For ages, I've been trying to get some money together and haven't been able to put out the follow-up to an album that I put together, a compilation I put together like 11 years ago now called Spiky Dread, which is basically, you know, essentially it's punky reggae.
Okay.
You know, it's punk and post-punk bands that made reggae and dub tunes. And the first one I went for, I played it safe and I got Bad Brains, I got The Slits and I got people like that.
Mm.
But the track that actually sold it, the distributor told me, was my brother-in-law's band from 1982 that never released their music because they split up before they'd actually finished recording pretty much. And they featured one of the Cardiacs. Was their drummer.
Oh, wow.
And Cardiac's completists heard about this and went, we need this. It was like, you know, they've been waiting for this to come.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a record they didn't know they needed. And I was just like, right. So really what I should be doing is finding the stuff that you can't find online. And so I spent the last decade finding or going through my records and finding records that you can't, you know, that aren't on Spotify, that everyone's forgotten about, self-release things. There's that era, like the punk era, the DIY, post-punk era, like all around the turn of the 80s, I've always found really fascinating. And so that's what I've been doing, like finding those tunes that no one's seen and trying to get them out there to people, you know, so that it's out there. And I think that's it. Just find stuff that people made for the love of it.
Mm. So it's like a bit, you're sort of doing like what Nuggets and Pebbles did for psych rock. You're doing for like that post-punk period.
Precisely.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Nice one. And what have you got anything, is anything up your sleeve that's imminent?
Yeah, well, I mean, the second album's been, about 3 years ago, I had it all ready pretty much. I had the track list and I've spoken to lots of people and I had it ready to be licensed. And then COVID happened and had no income. You know, and I've just been struggling to pay the bills ever since.
Yeah.
So it's just sitting there waiting. Sadly, like three different people that I was dealing with died in that time.
Oh, wow. Sorry.
Which is sadly the nature of, I guess, like that era. We're losing a lot of them, you know. So, you know, whether I can get it out, I don't know. If I can find someone that wants to get behind it and fund it, give us a shout.
We're going to move into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life.
Okay.
The rules of the game are simple. You've given me three films. I've got a timer. And every time we reach 5 minutes, we'll hear this sound. The great thing is you're sat opposite me. I don't have to say, can you hear that? Because if you can,
I've got problems.
And you've gone temporarily deaf in between the last conversation we had. So that will go off. We will start without further ado with the first one in your list, which is the classic space opera, Star Wars. I'm guessing The New Hope, when you said Star Wars.
So you've heard of it. It's an obscure 1977 film by a director called George Lucas.
Well, when people say Star Wars now, it could mean the whole franchise.
Yeah.
But obviously, to us, yes.
Let's just assume for these 5 minutes that the only film that exists is Star Wars.
Okay.
One film, 1977.
So where are you seeing this for the first time?
First time I saw it, I was 3 years old.
Okay.
So that would have been 1978. And because it didn't come out, a lot of people don't realize that it didn't come out until right at the end of 1977, just after Christmas in the UK. And it stayed at the cinemas for months and months, you know, like it's not like today where like films, everyone goes to the first weekend and then you basically go to an empty cinema.
Mm.
So we went probably around May 1978.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So I would have been just turning three.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember it because I was three.
Yeah.
Or just about three. But it's like a kind of residual memory.
Right.
I think we saw it in Kingston upon Thames in Southwest London, in a tiny little cinema that became a pine shop. Years later, I think it's gone now. I think the Rotunda Centre is on the site.
Weirdly, my local cinema became a pine shop, really? Then a block of flats.
Maybe it's a thing.
I think it's just big space for furniture.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even my local cinema. We lived in this town called Stoneleigh, which is sort of somewhere between, it's kind of like in the access of Wimbledon, Epsom and Kingston.
So how does a film you don't remember seeing stay in the memory that you saw it?
Well,
explain this to us.
So as I was growing up, obviously the first thing that really hit me that I became aware of were the figures in 78. My brother started getting them. He's 3.5 years older than me and he was playing with them. And that suddenly I had these like toys and these pictures on the back of the boxes. And there was this kind of this, you know, like character construction and a story coming out. So there's two versions of Star Wars in my head. There's the one that I know and everyone knows. And then there's the one that my brother lied to me about. As we were playing with the figures and he made up all this shit about all these characters that was nonsense. So when I saw it on, I think it got shown on telly, you know, probably not, the first Star Wars film got shown on telly quite quickly. And I remember like in the early 80s having it taped off telly and I used to watch it religiously. And it wasn't the film that he told me about. But the other thing was I had a best mate. Let's skip forward to about 1982.
Okay.
Had a best mate called Paul Withers and the pair of us were like obsessed with Star Wars figures and we used to watch it. He had it on tape as well off the telly. And that, and you know, we'd seen Empire Strikes Back by this point and we were completely invested in it. And so we were sitting there one day and I remember having this conversation. I was probably about 7 years old and we worked out that they weren't in space and they weren't in the Death Star. They were just in a room somewhere being filmed. And it was, I don't know what occurred to us. It was just like, that's, you know, this isn't, you can't go to space. You can't go and film this stuff. They're just in a building and someone's built it and someone's constructed this entire world to film. And
you as children were deconstructing the fourth wall.
7 years old. Honest to God, we had this conversation. And, you know, obviously, like, it was probably a little less analytical than this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not saying this is particularly analytical anyway, but we worked out. They were in a room and someone had built it and that was what filmmaking was. And I was like, fuck, I want to do this. I want to create worlds. I want to be inside that TV. I don't want to be in it.
Yeah,
but I want to be the person that's putting that stuff inside that TV or putting it on that screen. And so I remember being very young and I had that moment around sort of 7 or 8. I was just like, I want to be a filmmaker. And like the silliest thing was I looked at like pictures of film directors and I was kind of like, what do I need to be that? And one of the things that I saw was George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Spielberg, they all had beards. And I've got a beard now, but I'm still not a filmmaker. But the other thing is, so there's actually three Star Wars films.
Okay.
There's three versions of this film. So the thing, as I got older and I started breaking down what film was and art, what art was and what music was and all that, because at the same time I was really getting into music. I realized there was something more to this film than just like a space opera, something more than a big blockbuster. Oh, can I just finish this off? It's a DIY film. It's an experimental film. You know, it's the world's biggest budget experimental film. This was a guy who loved directors like Arthur Lipsett. I don't know if you know the Arthur Lipsett. He made a short film. He's a Canadian artist filmmaker in the early 60s. He made a film called 2187,
right,
which was just a load of kind of vignettes of like flashing images set to kind of sound montages. I think it started as a sound montage and then he put images to it.
Okay.
And cut loads of stuff really fast to it. And George Lucas saw that when he was at film school, and his first film, Look at Life, was 1 minute of stuff edited to a drum beat in the same style as 2187. He loved 2187 so much that actually the scene when they save Princess Leia, she's in prisoner's cell block 2187. When J.J. Abrams made his Star Wars film that does exist, but I shouldn't be talking about it after what I said, but what's his name? John Boyega's character is FN 2187. You know, so it's like, wow, this is an important thing. I was really into experimental film by this point as I was getting into my early teens, and I started watching people like John Acomfra, and that I was looking back to like... I've forgotten everyone's name, William Klein, Chris Marker. And I realized that George Lucas was watching these films. And if you watch the first Star Wars film, for what it really is, it was him expanding on his experimentation and putting that and finding a way of taking that to the public, to the mass market, and showing them an experimental film, which is why I think that's really fucking important. And so like on one side, it basically affected me because I was a kid watching this fantasy film. But at the same time, it also taught me a lot about DIY, not building shelves. Like, because I'm shit at that, but like making art based on, you know, what I have around me. And that's continued on to my music because I didn't really follow it as a film career.
Right then. Well, I wasn't expecting that sidebar, but thank you. So we're going to jump to 1970 for your second choice.
Yeah.
Brian De Palma's a name I know.
Yeah.
Now, you've just thrown a load of names at me, which I didn't know, and I didn't know this film title, Hi Mum, which is summarized on IMDb as a Vietnam vet moves into an apartment and peers through other people's windows across the street, meets a woman, and discovers black theatre. I mean, it's not high concept. So tell us where you are on the bus of meeting this film.
Basically the story of my life. You know, it's just, I saw it and I was like, this feels like me. I saw this film late night on cable. Like we got cable when I was a teenager at my mum and dad's house. It sort of came to Stoneleigh. And suddenly there are all these like extra channels. And I remember being up late one night. I just started art school. And I was just like watching any kind of weird shit that I could see and just tapping into culture, you know. And I was up late, nothing better to do, and this film came on. And I was just like, what's this? This is very unusual. That looks like Robert De Niro, but he looks very young. And I was just completely like, you know, knocked sideways by this film. It's kind of clunky, you know. It's like, it's obviously like, it's early Brian De Palma. It's kind of, again, it's a DIY thing. It's very much the product of that kind of downtown New York thing, a bit like, you know, Robert Downey's films of the 60s or whatever. It's slightly anarchic. It's got jokes that don't always land. But at the same time, it was just amazing to see Robert De Niro, very fresh-faced, kind of cutting his teeth and doing all the things that we'd get to know him as. There's literally a scene in this film where he does the whole, like, you talking to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like where he's auditioning for the role in this like off Broadway production where he has to play like a racist policeman. And he gets really into character and starts talking to a broom. and like treating it like it's like a sort of a young black person.
So in a weird way, there is a kind of almost like a space continuum where that character could have been Travis Bickle and Taxi Driver could have been a continuation of the story.
Yeah, completely. Because it ends with him, sorry to ruin it if no one's seen it, but it ends with him going to Vietnam. I'm confusing things. So the most confusing thing about this is when I saw it, I didn't realize it's a sequel to a film called Greetings.
Okay.
Where it ends with him going to Vietnam. The premise of Greetings is it's him and his mates in Greenwich Village desperately trying to get out of going to Vietnam. So right, they're like finding ways and he fails and ends up there. So this follows on from that. And he's a Vietnam veteran and he's just trying to make it in the world of art. And he gets involved in a porn company where he convinces this guy to give him the money to make what the guy thinks is going to be a porn film. It's what he describes as peep art.
Mm.
And it's just his kind of like his DIY art idea of like pointing his camera and filming people from across the way. And then he infiltrates their lives to try and then justify the fact that a pornographer has given him the money to make a porn film.
Mm.
So he then gets in there with this woman that he sees in the flat opposite and like orchestrates a relationship. It's very seedy and it's kind of wrong.
Yeah,
and
as a lot of 70s cinema is.
And it's also very Brian De Palma. It's about voyeurism and all that.
I mean, but it describes it as a comedy drama.
Yeah, it is a comedy.
It's funny.
It's dramatic. It has one scene in it. There's a whole sequence that's in a, like in some sort of like derelict building where it's a black power movement, white up, and then they black up the audience that come in to see them and treat them like they act like white racists.
Right.
And they threaten them and knock them around. And this is basically their play. And unfortunately, in one scene, they sexually assault someone with a broom.
Yeah.
It's not that descript, but it happens in the background. There's a lot of screaming. And it's weird that this is a black comedy, but also it's really quite difficult in places as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the thing that got me was just how the kind of the visceral nature of watching somebody enjoying the process of filmmaking. And that's what I've always got from Brian De Palma. Even if you're watching like something which is not his greatest work, but like Snake Eyes with Nicolas Cage, where it's like he does there's a lot of Hitchcock in De Palma films, but like he suddenly the camera comes out of the set and go and flies over the top of the set and you're looking through the buildings without letting you know it's a set strictly. But that's what I love about it because I get to see it and I think it's a set. It's like watching like a Jean-Luc Godard film or something where like he does pull the camera back and shows you you're on a set or something. I've always loved that idea of someone just kind of pulling back that curtain and going like, actually, here's what I'm doing and you're watching the film that I'm making. And yeah, so that's it. Hi Mum just blew me away. I saw a filmmaker making a film and I was just like, well, this is kind of what I got from George Lucas and I'm getting it again from Brian De Palma, who obviously was the guy that rewrote the crawl from Star Wars. So it sort of relates. I think he read George Lucas's opening crawl and went, you know, George, this is shit. Let me save you.
Well, why didn't you say? Yeah. I'm not the world's great authority on Star Wars, so I'll take any fact that you can throw at me. You could lie if you wanted. Right then, we're going to fast forward into the 21st century for your final choice. And this is Edgar Wright's horror comedy, Shaun of the Dead from 2004. Where are you seeing this? Why is something so much later in life having so much impact?
I didn't see Shaun of the Dead when it came out.
Okay.
Yeah, for some reason, I remember sitting in a cinema. I can't remember what I was watching. It might have been a disaster movie. I'm not sure. But I went to see it and the trailer for Shaun of the Dead came out and it actually made me angry. And I can't explain why. I remember throwing a Malteser at the screen in anger. And I don't know why, because I mean, I love the Romero films. And I think it just kind of like bugged me that someone had made a comedy. And it was just like, well, they're fucking making some bad pastiche of a zombie film. And then I realized that I was wrong. And I was just like, oh, it's the guys that made Spaced. You know, that could be all right. But I still didn't see it. And it wasn't until, and this is actually a romance tale. It wasn't until I met my girlfriend and we were hanging out. We were courting, as it were. And I went back to hers one night and she said, have you ever seen Shaun of the Dead? And I was just like, no. I haven't seen Shaun of the Dead. This is in 2006. So I was round at hers and she put on Shaun of the Dead and it was something that obviously had like really tickled her and she said, you need to see this. And we sat down and watched it together and it just became our film. And it was just like, we both realized that we had a very similar sense of humor. And I can't believe that I wasted that Malteser throwing at something, which is actually a really perfect film. I think the first two films, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, for me, are pitch perfect. They're really, really funny. And they're actually not pastiches at all. They're films that totally love the genre that they're part of rather than they're sending up.
I mean, yeah, Shaun of the Dead from a screenwriting point of view is the perfect rom-com.
Yeah.
It just happens to be set in a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Which is quite a trick to pull off.
But it's also a fantastic horror film as well.
It still has horror beats.
Yeah, and there are moments in it that are genuinely quite upsetting. Like when they run over the guy in the street and then they pull up to see if he's okay. And there's the whole joke where he's like, oh, it's all right, he's a zombie. But the guy actually scares me.
Mm.
So it's weird to find something hilarious and scary at the same time. And they pulled it off. It's fucking brilliant. But yeah, so the thing that really got me about that film was it became our film, me and my girlfriend's film, and we're still together, you know, all these years later, and we're parents and we live in a house around a corner from you. And so yeah, that film is really important to me. And I like Edgar Wright. Like, I don't know him personally. We did speak once via direct message on Twitter when I put up, it was around the time the Queen died last year, and I put up a gif of Simon Pegg saying goodbye Liz from Shaun of the Dead, and he was like, please send me that, that's fantastic. So we spoke really briefly, but yeah, he just seems like someone, I mean, he's around the same age as me, he's got really similar interests. I've always just kind of struck me as like, if I ever bumped into Edgar Wright, I think we'd probably have a lot to chat about, but I'm also not a stalker. should add, in the days of, you know, like hyper connectivity.
So what would be a scene that stands out for you in Shaun of the Dead?
The scene that stands out most is when they're walking down the back alley of the houses and they come across his ex-girlfriend's friends and mum, and they're like the kind of mirror image of the two. And I love the joke and I love the gag, but the thing that actually I love most about it is the back alleys of suburban houses, because it just totally reminds me of growing up in suburbia. And that's one of the things that actually really hit me. Like, my girlfriend always jokes and says that Shaun's mum really reminds her of my mum. The kind of like not wanting to worry him, even though she's basically about to turn into a zombie and all that. I mean, like, my best friend, like, this is quite sad, but my best friend hanged himself when I was 25. And my mum didn't tell me straight away because she's like, thought it might upset you. And I was like, well, yes.
Yeah,
it would. But so it's kind of, they got that. There's so many beats in that film. They got so many characters and so many aspects of that kind of lifestyle to a T, and it really resonated. But the most important thing is it was the film that really made me realize that it was like me and my girlfriend were meant to be together.
That's quite powerful.
And the other thing is it opens with Ghost Town by The Specials, which is obviously a really important tune.
There we go. And on that cultural bombshell, I thank you for three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. We had Star Wars, because that's all there ever was. Hi Mom, Brian De Palma's early movie.
Hi Mom, with the exclamation mark.
With the exclamation mark, yes. And Shaun of the Dead from 2004. And it just gives me, DJ Wrong Tom, to say thank you very much for joining me on the Britflix podcast.
Cheers for getting us in. It was great.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.